Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Iris W. from Colts Neck, New Jersey, and her home group is Steps by the Book.
Okay, I'm on. Good? Hear me? Not standby, on. Wow, you guys even dim the lights. That's really nice. Yeah, thank you. As you can see, we're from New Jersey. Hi, my name is Iris, and I'm an alcoholic.
Iris.
My sobriety date is April 17th, 1995, and I can tell you that it is because of a kind, loving, forgiving, heck of a sense of humor, higher power, that I found by going through the steps that are outlined in the big book, Alcoholics Anonymous, that I'm standing here sober before you today. I live in Freehold, New Jersey. My home group is in Colts Neck. And, you know, Karen and Alex, they live down by the shore, and Michaela. And, Carrie, who drove us, lives around the corner. But in Freehold, it was monsooning. I'm talking monsooning. You know, as soon as I left work early, I had said yes to coming to speak while I was on vacation in Disney. Sarah, so thank you for asking, and I'm thinking Quakertown. Where the heck is Quakertown? And somebody said to me, they have good cookies in Quakertown. I'm like, all right, so we're off to Quakertown. But it was so bad, and it was, you know, everyone was trying to get there, and we were late, and I was kind of wondering if we were ever even going to make it here. And I'm glad we did. I'm really glad we did, so thanks for being here. You know, down by Colts Neck, we always like to start our big book meeting with a really bad joke. And I'm talking about really bad joke. And the greatest thing about it, you know, I started Colts Neck, Steps by the Book group, 15 years ago. And I started it as a women's meeting. And, you know, I started it because I had just finished going through the steps that are outlined in the book. And I'll talk about that a lot. And there were no big book meetings, really, back then. You know, I'm sober, God willing, 19 years. And, you know, back then, there just weren't as many big book meetings as there are today. So when we had started Colts Neck, I had started as a women's meeting. And really, the only women that went were the women that I sponsored. That was it. And we really weren't self-supporting because I'm going to talk a lot about good sponsorship. Because I wouldn't be standing here today without good sponsorship. None of this did I do by myself. I did this because someone reached out their hand and somebody helped me. That's why I'm standing here. And you know, when we switched the meeting from a women's meeting over to a mixed meeting, the truth was we were hoping if we added men, a lot more women would come. You know? I swear. And I started it with my husband. He's now my ex-husband at the time. Nothing to do with the meeting, I swear. And my sponsor at the time, and I had a male sponsor, I'll talk about that too. But one of the things that we promised ourselves, we used to call them Bert and Ernie, is that we were always going to start off the meeting because people used to come to Colts Neck, and they used to look at you, and we used to sit up at that table, and everybody was so serious. You could hear a pin drop, you know, that they were just going to get cured, you know, by just sitting in the room. So we always started with a really bad joke. And I think the best thing about the car trip is the really bad jokes that we tell to make a decision about what's going to be taken from the podium, because there are some really bad jokes. But I like this one. I think this one's funny. So a drunk walks into a bar in Manhattan, and he sits down at the bar, and he says to the bartender, "I need 3 ice-cold beers." So the bartender lined up 3 ice-cold beers. The guy sat down, and he took a sip out of one. He took a sip out of the second. He took a sip out of the third. And he continued to do that the whole time. He then turned to the barkeeper after he was done, and he said, "Can I have 3 more ice-cold beers, please?" And the bartender lined him up again. And he's watching this dude, and he comes over to him, and he says, "Listen, if the problem is that you just want your beers ice-cold," and yes, I'm from Brooklyn, and that's how I say beer, by the way, it's beers. "If you just want them ice cold, I'll take care of you. I'll hook you up." He said, "No, that's not why I'm doing it. I'm doing it because we have this little thing going with my brothers. We made a pact that every Saturday night at 8 o'clock, we were all going to go into a pub or a bar, and we were going to drink together. But one of my brothers is in Australia, and the other one's in California. And the bartender was like, wow, you know, that's so cool. That is just so nice. What a family tradition, you know? So the guy continued to do this for the next couple of months, and the bartender got very used to him. One day, the guy walks into the bar, and he says, I'll take two ice-cold beers. And the bartender put two ice-cold beers in front of him and went over. He's cleaning glasses. He's watching him. The guy did exactly the same thing. He took a sip out of the first one. He took a sip out of the second one. He proceeded to drink that way and ordered two more. The bartender let him get settled, and then he walked over to him, and he says, you know, knowing your story, I just have to say something. He said, I'm very sorry for the loss of your brother. And the guy said, what are you talking about? My brother's fine. I just quit drinking. See, so that one I like. I have to admit, some of the ones Carrie brought up, they were really good. Just can't always tell them from the podium. You know? I'm going to talk to you just a little bit about my drinking. I don't believe in telling a whole bunch of war stories. I like talking about recovery and all the bumps and bruises that come along the way there, too. You know, I had my first drink when I was 12 years old. I was raised in Brooklyn, in Canarsie, and I was raised Jewish. And I had my first drink at a Passover Seder. And a lot of people don't know what a Passover Seder is. So what's a Passover Seder? It's kind of like a big book meeting. Think of it as a big book meeting. You know, everyone sits around the dining room. I mean, you know, your whole dysfunctional family. And everyone sits around the dining room, and we read out of a book. And in the book is clear-cut directions on how to proceed with the Seder or with the evening. And one of the clear-cut directions, though, is to drink. And what we used to drink was that really great Manischewitz wine, you know, the stuff that things stand up in. And you have to drink between 8 and 12 glasses of that. And, you know, I was 12 years old. We were in Massachusetts. And I was sitting next to my cousin's boyfriend, may she rest in peace. And, you know, he thought it would be really, really cool if he got me drunk. So he kept filling him up and filling him up. And I ended up underneath the table with a really, really, really smelly poodle. And I remember the drive back to Canarsie. It wasn't fun, you know, when you drink that stuff and it's thick and it's disgusting and it's in your head and you feel really sick and you're laying down. And I remember my mother saying to my father, well, she'll never do that again. And, you know, I didn't until I was 16. And then the horse was out of the barn, you know. Growing up in Brooklyn, drinking was an activity. It's something you did. You did it before you went bowling. You did it before you went to the movies. You did it before you went out. You did it before you went to a party. Because for me, there was never enough alcohol at a party. So if I would get drunk before I would go, I'd be willing to go to the party. Because then I didn't have to worry about how much booze was going to be there. You know, I pretty much drank hard, straight from the get-go. I can never stand up here and I can never glamorize it. I can never make it sound good. You know, was it fun times? Yeah, there were some fun times. Do I remember all of them? Nah. That's a blackout drinker, you know? So the bottom line is, I stopped drinking because alcohol stopped working for me. That's why I stopped drinking. If I can still drink and alcohol would have made everything wonderful, I wouldn't be here tonight, which I'm sure a lot of you guys wouldn't either. I did a lot that a lot of other people did. You know, in 19 years of sponsorship, and I've sponsored hundreds and hundreds of women. I really have been blessed. And, you know, I've heard a lot of sad stories. And I'm standing up here, but I can tell you that I don't come from a dysfunctional home. The only dysfunction from my house is standing right here. That's it. I have wonderful parents. I do. I have wonderful parents. You know, I was adopted. And I used to think that the problem, the reason why I drank was because I was mentally ill. And when I started going through the big book, I learned that I was mentally ill when it came to alcohol. But I used to blame it on the fact that I was adopted. Because my parents did not drink the way I drank. They did not do the things that I did. You know, I still have them. I'm so blessed. I really am. I did what a lot of people did. I married my drinking buddy. I thought it was the right thing to do. We had a beautiful daughter. I had a choice of moving to Long Island or moving to New Jersey, and I picked New Jersey. But if you ask me, I'm going to still tell you I'm from Brooklyn. And we moved to New Jersey, and I remember sitting home. My husband at the time, he worked in Manhattan, and I remember sitting home, and I remember saying, there are no sidewalks, there are no schools, there are no stoops, there are no people. There are no people anywhere. If you needed to get anything, you had to get in the car, and you had to drive to the store 5 miles away. I hated New Jersey, so I kept making an excuse to go back to Brooklyn with all my old friends. When I got to New Jersey, I started drinking 7 days a week. You know, I blame New Jersey. That was the bottom line. I had my son, and I thought I would behave myself then, and that didn't work either. You see, what worked for me, am I doing that? What worked for me is alcohol stopped working for me. That's what worked for me. That was it. Alcohol stopped working for me. You know, I used to drink myself to sleep. I used to not know what I did, how I woke up, where the kids were, where I was. That's the way I drank. I tried different ways to stop drinking. Just like they say in the big book, I did them all. I even bought the book, How to Quit Drinking Without Alcoholics Anonymous. They really do make a book like that. And I used to read it while sitting on my exercise bike, drinking a glass of wine in front of the TV, thinking, if I exercise while reading this book, I won't want to drink anymore. Obviously, it didn't work. But that's what I used to do. I tried everything. I tried therapy. Well, I tried lying to a therapist. I tried everything. I tried doctors. I tried everything. And the bottom line was, every time I would get in trouble, and my husband would say to me, you've got to quit drinking, I would say, I promise I'll be good. I promise I'll be good. And I genuinely wanted to be good. I did. I wanted to be good. But I couldn't be good. Because one day would pass and I would be crawling out of my skin. Crawling out of my skin. And I didn't know. Even when I couldn't, I still didn't know that I couldn't stop drinking. I just didn't know. You know, it finally got so bad when I was living in Freehold that when I used to go to sleep, I didn't go to sleep, I blacked out. I used to wake up, obviously, when the alcohol wore off. And I used to have these horrible thoughts. And again, I thought I was losing my mind. I met a wonderful shrink. I always thank God for Dr. London, because he just didn't cut any bull. And he looked me dead in the face, and he said to me, you know what? You're a drunk. You have an alcohol problem. You have an alcohol problem. And I suggest you go away really quickly and separate yourself. And I explained to him what a great mother I was, even though I was blacking out on the couch. I explained to him what a great wife I was, even though I didn't cook, I didn't do laundry, I didn't clean, I didn't do anything. I drank. I explained all those things to him. So he told me that maybe if I can stop drinking, seeing him every day, 7 days straight, let's see if it works that way. And those wonderful parents I talk about, they're school teachers, they're retired school teachers from Brooklyn, came out over Easter vacation and took care of the kids. And for 7 days, my skin crawled. I didn't sleep. I couldn't eat. I vomited. I saw crawly things. And I would walk circles around my house. And that's what I did for 7 days. And I would see Dr. London every day on those 7 days. And finally he said to me, all right, it's time for you to go to a meeting. And you know, I tell you that I'm a real tough girl. You know, I grew up in Brooklyn. I went to a lot of places I shouldn't have been. A lot of places I don't remember being, thank God. And I did a lot of things that I shouldn't have done. But when he said I had to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was petrified. Petrified. So, you know, I drove around. I got sober in the clubhouse in Freehold. And a lot of people know the clubhouse in Freehold. They have meetings. Thank God for the clubhouse. They have meetings from 9 o'clock in the morning to 8 o'clock at night. 7 days a week. It was a clubhouse. You know, people were always hanging out. People were always there, you know. And I remember I would drive around, and it was in a strip mall. And, you know, I would check it out. And I would try to figure out what the front door is. Like here you can obviously see where the front door is. See there, there were two doors. And I would see where everybody was smoking. Because I was thinking to myself, these people smoke a lot. And they were all hanging out in the back. So I had to figure that out how to be the front door, right? Because I had to all come through it. So I was going to come in through the back door. Okay? So it was a 12:30 meeting. I waited till exactly 12:31 because I didn't want anyone to know I was coming in. I saw no one was in the parking lot. I parked on the other side. And when I opened the door, I walked right into the 12 steps because they had it on a podium over there. And I ended up coming in the front door that they didn't use, by the way, and they still don't use. And that meeting had about 80 people in it, and it was all different people. It was the lawyers from the courts. It was the doctors from the hospital. It was construction workers. It was such a diverse crowd. Just like it says on page 17, we are people that normally would not mix. And everybody looked up and looked at me, and I wanted to die. Really. I wanted a big hole to just open up, and I wanted to jump into it because I'm like, how the hell did I get here? I didn't know. Somebody was kind enough to get up, and I sat down, and I never got up. You know, it probably took me about 5 months to get up and go get a cup of coffee like he's doing. Because I figured if I did that, you were all going to be looking at me. Or if I had to go to the bathroom, I would suffer. I mean, suffer until the end, because I didn't want to walk around. That's how paranoid I was. I really didn't want to talk to you, and I didn't want to walk around. You know, my mother, God bless her, gotta love my mother. She went to OA, so she thought she knew all about AA. And you're growing up Jewish, she said to me, you know, don't ever say those prayers. They're going to want to hold hands. They're probably going to want to convert you. So be careful who you talk to, and don't tell anybody anything, because a secret's not a secret once you tell somebody. So don't tell anybody. You know, and I used to sit and I used to listen. And, you know, God, like I said, has a great sense of humor. And he put this woman, Diane, there. Now, Diane, she was a real alcoholic. Diane was the one who used to show up at the pool parties with a suitcase of beer in one hand and a bottle of vodka in the other hand. Because she was my friend. You know, she was the girl you wanted to hang out with. But everyone always talked about Diane and Diane's drinking problem. And lo and behold, right across the room, there sat Diane. And thank God for Diane. She said to me, I can't sponsor you, but I can take you to meetings. And she did. She took me around to meetings. And you know, for a year and a half, I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. And I sat in those seats, and I got sicker. I didn't get better. People kept telling me, you're a winner. But I didn't feel like a winner. You see, because in a year and a half of not drinking, going to meetings, I did nothing. I made coffee. I did. I went on commitments. I went to those places where nobody else would go. I did the criminally insane up at New Hope, one of the institutions that are now closed. I used to do Clinton State Prison, where nobody would go. I had absolutely nothing to say, but I said a lot. You know, my sponsor was another woman who came over to me, who was also Jewish, by the way. It was funny as hell. My mother told me there's no Jews in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had to get my first sponsor. I had to be a Jew to shut my mother up. And, you know, what she had taught me, I believe everybody's in my life for a reason, including up here. That's the way I believe, that everybody's here for a reason, whether I like it or not. Whether I like it or not. And, you know, the problem that we had there is it used to be a group sponsorship. I would tell her, and she would tell her, and she would tell her, and then I'd walk into the meeting at 12:30, and everyone would look at me and go, Iris, you shouldn't do that. And I used to think to myself, really? Is this how this works here? And then my second sponsor that I had gotten at the time, great lady, got me involved in the jails and the institutions and the criminally insane. I did 7 commitments. I went on commitments every day of the week. I was not home. I was not a wife. I was not a mother. I was running around Alcoholics Anonymous, a married woman, acting like a singles woman, thinking that AA was the dating game. But people were telling me I was a winner because I wasn't drinking. And I didn't feel like a winner at all. You know, my second sponsor had to move in the middle of the night. I still don't know why Christy moved in the middle of the night, but it's okay. Because again, everything happens for a reason. She said to me in the clubhouse parking lot, I gotta go. I can't tell you why. Give me at least a week. And then ask, you know, go find a new sponsor. You know, ask Cheryl. She's nice. Or ask Debbie. She's nice. But don't tell anybody. So at about that time, at a year and a half of the stuff that was going on, I really didn't want to drink. I wanted to kill myself. It's that simple. I didn't want to drink. I'm stubborn. I'm still stubborn. 19 years later, I'm still stubborn. But I didn't want to drink. I wanted to die. Because I couldn't imagine living life without alcohol, but I couldn't imagine going back to it. And I just didn't know where to go. I had no clue where to go. And I would ask people, I don't know, they keep talking about the steps. Does anybody do the steps? And women would say to me, I'll sponsor you. And I'd say, well, did you go through the steps? And they'd say, we can read the step book. And I'm like, I read the step book. I'm still here. And I don't feel like a winner. You would ask me how I was doing, and I'd be like, I'm doing fine. I would just lie right to your face, because that's what I did my whole life. I lied. I never told anybody anything or how I was feeling. And to be honest, I never cared about how anybody else was feeling either. So in a year and a half of not drinking, running around as a married woman, doing things I was not proud of, I didn't want to drink, I wanted to kill myself. But like I said, my higher power has a hell of a sense of humor. And there used to be this little man, and there was a meeting. See, I'm going to date myself, but 19 years ago, 18 years ago, you can smoke in meetings. It's like, you could smoke. You didn't have to smoke, because if the person next to you was smoking, you were smoking. And even if you didn't smoke, you went home and you smelled so bad, it was unbelievable. And we had a job in AA, and it was cleaning up the ashtrays, really, and sweeping up the butts. And that's what you do. You know, you sat in this room, and you cannot see across to the other side. And I used to hear this rough little voice, like everyone would be talking about their dog throwing up on the carpeting and the color of the wallpaper and my daughter's pregnant. And I'd be sitting there, and then this voice would come out and say something like, you know, something crazy like, well, when I do the third step, and, you know, I took the third step on my knees with my sponsor, and people would roll their eyes and, you know, say something. But he was always happy. He was like the village idiot. He was always happy. He was never unhappy. And he was short, and he lost a finger. He had one of his fingers were cut off, and he used to smoke. And he always used to talk to me, and he kept saying to me, you know, you look so tortured. Like, just looking in your eyes, I can see. And he was right. And someone double dared me, and I asked Greg to be my sponsor. And, you know, for 13 years, that man who lived under a bridge in a box before he got sober on Route 17 in Paramus sat down and took me with a college degree through the big book. He taught me how to live sober. That's what he did. He saved my butt. That's it. That's it. I can never stand up here and tell you what I did. I showed up. It was either showing up or dying. See, for me, pain was a great motivator. I'm not like a superhero that just always wants to go in front of the pack. I had to be really lagging behind and suffering pretty bad to want to change. I don't like changing. And I remember when I asked him to sponsor me, I think the line goes, he recoiled from me like a hot stove. But he didn't say no. He didn't say no. And he said to me, here's the rules. You're going to show up at my house every Wednesday night at 7 o'clock with an Entenmann's cake. If you forget the cake, don't come in. If you come at 7:05, don't bother coming. I don't want to hear that you're tired or you're cranky or you have a date. I don't want to hear it. I'm making a commitment to you, and you're making a commitment to me. And that's it. And this isn't complicated. We're going to read the black. And we're going to follow the directions as outlined in the book. And where it says pray, we're going to pray. Where it says write, you're going to write. And you're going to get better. And that's it. And I thought to myself, how the hell did I get here? Was it really that bad? And every Wednesday night, I came with that Entenmann's cake. I learned to bring a cup of tea also. He was less grumpy. And I would sit down. And this man who learned to read from tapes that he listened to while laying in bed at night would read to me. And I would think to myself, really? Really? Are you going to read to me the whole time? And he did. And then he would tell me words to look up. And I would go home and I would look up the words and I had to write them down. And I brought them back and he used to transfer them into his book. He certainly wasn't dumb. And you know, I wrote all those words. He brought me to my first Joe and Charlie seminar up in Manhattan, another one in Cherry Hill. He showed me how to keep a commitment. He showed me how to keep a commitment. That's what he did for me, you know? Like when it was raining and pouring, there's no whining. You just get in the car and you go, because it tells me in the big book that God is going to keep me protected. Wherever I go, with good reason, God's going to keep me protected. And the crazy thing happened. I kept doing it and doing it and doing it, and it works. It works. Just like I went in the bathroom before I stood up in front of you nice people, because I'm scared. And I hit my knees in the bathroom, and I said the fair prayer. And it worked. It worked. I was able to get up here, and it worked. And I do it every time. That's how I know it works, you know? That's how I know. We went through the book, and I highlighted, and we went through Bill's story, and I identified, and he asked me if there's anything I'm not willing to do, and you better say it now, like I said to the ladies that were driving up there. And I said no. And you know what? There wasn't. He asked me to write down my conception of God before we had gotten started and write it on a piece of paper. Greg used to work nights. So after a meeting, I would have my homework, because I had homework, and I'd go to the diner with him. He would eat, and whatever other sponsees or other people that were coming. So like I said to you, I was raised Jewish, and in the Jewish religion, the way you write God is G/D. You're not allowed to write the full name of God. If you do write the full name of God, you have to keep that piece of paper forever. You're not allowed to destroy it. But if you write G/D, you can rip it up and destroy it. Okay? So when I wrote my conception of God, I wrote G/D. And it was not a good conception of God. And I wasn't a good... I always told the truth. And, you know, it was a little hostile. But when I wrote it down, but he didn't notice the hostility. He didn't notice the negative. He noticed how I wrote the word God. And he looked across the table at me and he said, what the hell is this? I said, what are you talking about? That's how you spell God. He's like, listen, I didn't go to college like you, but that's not how you spell God. It's G-O-D. What is wrong with you? So I explained to him just like I explained to him, figuring, and I batted my baby blues, and I figured, there's not going to be a problem, is there? He's like, yeah, there is. Because that's an old idea. And you're here to get rid of old ideas. And I said, what's the big deal? Why are you making a big deal out of this? He said, all right, you told me you're willing to go to any lengths, correct? I said, yes, I'm here. I'm here. Am I not here? Which, you know, I'm gifting him with my present. He should be thrilled. He wasn't. He said, I want you to write G-O-D. So I'm like, you know what? I could outsmart him. I wrote G-O-D. I'll put it in my pocket. I'll take it home. I'll bury it in the backyard. No one will even know. My mother won't know. No one will know. I'll be all right. He says to me, what is the big deal? I said, well, the big deal is if you rip it up, all right, the bottom line is we can all go to hell. He's like, yeah, so? You're not scaring me yet. I said, better yet, lightning can come through the roof of the diner. It could all go on fire, or worse, my mother can call, and that'll definitely be the end of all of us. He said, that's fine. Write it. I wrote it. He goes, now rip it up. As corny as it sounds, and every time I say it, I say to myself, I can't believe I'm telling all these people this really corny story. But as corny as it sounds, I was petrified to rip that up. You know, that was an old idea I had. There was not a soul in the diner. It was me, my husband, another one of Greg's sponsors, George, who owned the diner, and Greg. And he said to me, once again, I'm going to remind you, any lengths, or go find another sponsor. I closed my eyes real tight, being a little drama queen. I ripped it up into a million pieces, and I threw it down in my dish. When I opened my eyes, they were all gone from around the table. And I'm thinking to myself, oh my God, it was true. It's true. It's true. And then very slowly, they came up from behind the booth, one at a time, and they all said, just in case. Just in case we wanted to be safe. And I look like a loser. And then they all came back to the table and they were like, see, nothing happened, you know? And I'm thinking to myself, wow, nothing happened. Mud and call, She probably won't know if I didn't tell her. Nothing happened. And that's what we did. It was little tiny baby steps and a lot of laughing, a lot of laughing, you know? I remember when I said to Greg that when we went to take the third step and he said, we're going to get on our knees. And I'm like, nah, I don't want to. He's like, yeah, I don't care. Now, if Greg tells the story, he's going to tell you that I kept one knee up. Since I'm telling the story, I'm going to tell you that I had both knees down, I was a great sponsee, and I said the third step. That's what I'm going to tell you. And you know, it's an amazing thing. Again, little baby steps. That's what they were. And that's how it had to be for me. You know, after we did that and I sat down and I started writing, I had to write my fourth step. And I don't know about you, but, you know, to me it was a novel, Gone with the Wind. I finally get the opportunity to tell somebody what all you bad people did to me in my lifetime. I get to tell you. Because I was a victim. You know, it was never what I did to you. It was never what I did to you with my drinking. It was never what I did to you with anything of my actions. It was what you did to me, and that's all that mattered. I was a one-way street. And when I sat down and I started writing, I love column one and I love column two. Because column two, I got to tell you what happened. What did they do to me? You know, because it was all about me. My son used to have a shirt that said, yes, indeed, the world does revolve around me. And, you know, my sponsor used to say I should borrow it all the time. Because that's truly what I thought. Truly what I thought. You know, when I wrote down in column two and I wrote down in column three, and I sat and I looked, I had two things that I was going to bring to the grave with me. Two things that I thought were so horrendous that I was not going to share with anybody. And to be honest, I don't talk about them from the podium. I do talk about them if people approach me after. I talk about it a lot with my sponsees because I realize it didn't just happen to me. You know, after listening to as many fifth steps as I have been blessed to listen to, it didn't just happen to me. But, you know, I left those two spots empty, and I kept writing. You know, column by column, we did it exactly as it was outlined. We weren't allowed to not do it as outlined. And I left those two horrible things off. And, you know, I finally shared it with my husband and at the time. And, you know, he didn't run screaming from the room. He didn't look at me differently. He didn't stop sleeping in the bed with me. He didn't tell other people. He said, you need to share it with your sponsor. And if you're confused, share it with him, and he could help you write it out. And that's what I did. And then I did something totally unlike me in the next column, in column four. I looked at it from an entirely different angle. I looked at what I did. I looked at what I did. And that was such an amazing thing. Depressing in some cases, but amazing. And I sat down and I looked at it, and then I looked at column five. And column five had a hell of a pattern. Selfish, self-centered, inconsiderate, dishonest, frightful, frightened. You know, that was my M.O. I sat down every Wednesday night and I wrote. And I wrote and I wrote and I wrote. And you know, when it came down to the fifth step, the great thing about it is I had gotten to know my sponsor really, really well. So I wasn't afraid to sit down and share anything. But when I got to the fifth step and, you know, the rubber hit the road, I was a little nervous. And I remember that as we were going through the parts I was laughing at, he wasn't laughing, which tells you how warped my thinking was. The parts I was crying at and sobbing at and trying to sell him on exactly what happened, he was laughing at, which kind of explains where my brain was. You know, I tell everybody that I work with from the get-go, and the only reason I tell them is because it's my experience. See, I had to clean up my thinking before I can clean up my drinking. See, I don't believe in acting my way sober. I believe that I have to clean up my thinking, and then I'll clean up my drinking. And cleaning up my thinking cleans up my actions. And that's it. And the only way I can do that is through God and through the steps as outlined in the book. We sat down and we did the fifth step. It took a really, really long time. They ain't kidding when they say a really long talk. It was torturous. I can't say, you know, I had a freeing moment. I didn't. See, I'm one of those people that had to keep moving. I didn't see a rainbow. I didn't see unicorns. I felt bad. You know, I felt bad about looking at it. And when somebody was sitting there, and he turned to me and he said, "Do you really realize that your whole life you have been a selfish, self-seeking, inconsiderate, frightened, spoiled little brat?" I was aghast. I mean, even after writing it all down, you know, to have someone say it right to your face, it's pretty rough. But you know, again, thank God for good sponsorship. Thank God for the fire he continued to light under my butt. He had said to me when I first sat down, he said to me, "I'm going to ask you, one, that you show up, you make the commitment. Two, that as soon as we start moving forward, you start sponsoring women." See, again, back then, there wasn't a big book meeting every night. There was not a big book meeting every night. You know, there were a lot of different other meetings. Cult Snack was one of the first big book meetings that started pretty much up in Monmouth County, which in turn started, you know, Design for Living and a whole bunch of wonderful meetings. Wonderful meetings. But, you know, for me, and I always have to talk about me, I can't talk about anybody else. I used to be, as they would affectionately call, a hell of a big book thumper. I'd want to bash people on the head with the big book nonstop. But I realized something. A, from the podium, it gets me nowhere. And B, sitting across from somebody I'm sponsoring, it gets me nowhere. The reason I sit down with someone is so they get an experience of going through the book so they can have a conception of a higher power. And in turn, help somebody else. You know, that's what I was taught. And, you know, right out of the gate, at 90 days, I started sponsoring people. And then in a year, I started really sponsoring ladies because I was the only one sitting down and going out of the big book. There was a time I had 17 to 19 ladies at my dining room table. It was surreal. It really was. And it was a gift. It was a gift. But I don't know if I forgot to tell you, when I first came in, I didn't really like ladies. I didn't like hanging out with girls at all. And, you know, I have a great sponsor now. I've since, you know, me and Greg, thank God for him again, we've parted ways. There are now women that have gone through the steps and a very, very good selection, thank goodness, of women sponsors. And I have a great sponsor now. She's a lot smarter than me, though. That was really funny. She's one of those people with a PhD. It's kind of like sitting across from her asking her to look up a word was like, "Really, are you kidding? Are you kidding? How can I even ask her to look up a word? She has a PhD. But that's the kind of people that we meet. Straight out of the box, Greg started making me make amends. And I don't know about you guys, but when you start getting at your amends process, the world gets a lot smaller. Everybody shops in ShopRite, or everybody is in 7-Eleven. I'm talking people you have not seen in 25 or 30 years. They're freaking in the frozen food aisle in ShopRite. And you're thinking to yourself, "Really, I haven't seen you in years." And you pull out the card, and you think about it, and you look at it. But again, thank God for good sponsorship. I can make no amends without going through my sponsor. No amends, because I would even screw that up. You know? And I got to be honest with you, there's only one amends that I made that didn't go the way that was, you know, warm and fuzzy. I have not had another bad experience. I've been with sponsees that have had some interesting experiences, but I have not. And I got to be honest with you, after you make amends to one person for three times, you really learn how to shut your mouth. You know, when I first started sitting down, I used to be told all the time by Greg's sponsor, God bless him, Dennis, he'd say, "You know, Iris, it's not about not drinking anymore. It's about learning to shut up. Just learning about not saying what the first thing that comes to your mouth is. That's what it's about. When in doubt, do leave it out. If you question it, don't say it." And it was really, really hard for me to learn. Really hard for me to learn. But you know, like I said, after you make amends three times to one person, this one woman, I constantly was threatening to crack her in the jaw. Didn't go very well. Every time I had to make amends to her. Do you know, when this woman used to walk in the room, I used to freeze. I want to run to the bathroom so I wouldn't be in the same room with her, but I didn't know what was going to happen. You know, I was almost petrified of her by this point. When we talk about steps 10 and 11, I always used to think I was doing 11 really, really bad. I'm not going to stand up here and tell you that I meditate an hour a day. I don't. I have learned to pray. And just like I said to you, I don't think twice about going in the bathroom, and I've been to some really interesting bathrooms, and hitting my knees and saying the fair prayer and asking God to let me help one person tonight. Just one. That's all that matters, is if I help one person. And that's what I do every time before I speak, no matter where it is. I do that. You know, 19 years of being sober, what a gift and what a ride it has been. It hasn't always been smooth and easy, but boy, oh boy, it's been interesting. You know, a good sponsorship also takes you through the traditions, and it takes you through the 12 concepts, which I really want to rip my hair out of. And I got to admit, I really didn't enjoy it. And I found a lot of times that, especially on a service plane, I always come back to the group. I always come back to standing in the front, shaking someone's hand, and welcoming you to Cold Snack, or just making coffee. We also have a meeting on Thursday night. And Thursday night is another meeting that Cold Snack started, and it's just a speaker's meeting, meaning someone just sits up there and shares a little bit about the chapter. Very laid back, very small, very nice. And I always try and make sure that I get there, because there's always new people there. And I always want to be there to welcome them. You know, I was taught by my sponsor that I don't just give somebody my number, I take their number. Because I don't know about you guys, but when I came in, I wasn't calling. Yeah, call me. Yeah, all right. I was not doing that. I didn't want to do anything. You know, I was miserable. I wasn't going to call you. If I was going to call you, all I was really going to do was probably listen to you, because I was not going to tell you anything about me. Anything at all. You know, I wish that I can tell you that the first time I went through the steps, I had this, you know, humongous spiritual awakening. It took me a long time. I'm a process. It took me a while. I always say that I had a hell of a spiritual awakening. And it was little and it was slow. I've been to lots of big book studies. I have had the honor of sitting in a lot of great places with a lot of good people. So interesting. And I've learned so much. But most important, what I learned, what saves my butt time and time again, is it's not about me, it's about helping another alcoholic. Again and again and again. You know, I found myself single at 50. 50 and free, however you want to really put it. Wasn't in the plan. My son decided that at that time also, he was going to go join the Green Berets. He was going to go join the Special Forces. And you know, I also changed my job. Everything kind of happened at the exact same time. My mother fell down, broke both ankles. It was a heck of a year, a heck of a year. And you know, it wasn't in my plan. And to be honest with you, I stayed away from Alcoholics Anonymous a lot, because at the time, you know, I was uncomfortable, because everybody knew my ex-husband, Peter. And everyone would come over to me, and everyone would say, oh my God, how are you doing? And it would be all this mush and nonsense. And that's not what I wanted to hear when I came to a meeting. I just wanted to sit down, and I wanted to go to a meeting, you know? And it was very difficult. It was really difficult. And, you know, the first time Jordan got deployed, and he went to Afghanistan on a mission, he's in global, so he goes away just in the middle of the night. And you get a phone call. I had had the opportunity to say goodbye to him this time, which was heart-wrenching, you know. And when you're laying in bed at night and you're by yourself and you sit up in the middle of the night and you think to yourself, where's my son? I don't know where my kid is. But genuinely don't know where my kid is. He's somewhere. People are trying to kill him. I don't know where my kid is. You know, and it's 2, 3 o'clock in the morning. Well, you know, that's why I tell that story in the diner. Because at 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning, the only thing between me and a drink is God. It's not my sponsor. It's not my parents. It's not my kids. It ain't even my network. It's God. And when I hit my knees at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and all I do is pray for the safety of my son and his squad, I get a tiny little sense of well-being. And that's what kept me going for 3 long years. and I got three more going. You know, Jordan's so funny because he'll say, he'll be going away and I'll be snotting and crying. And he'll be like, real good job, Mom. Make it all about you. I'm going to dodge bullets. But no, Mom, let me sit down and let me help you through this very hard time. That's my kid. I'm kicking my butt, which I deserve. And I'm like, no, you can't go. But you know what? It just reminds me again and again that the fellowship alone was not going to keep me sober. But I needed a whole lot more than the fellowship. I needed a lot more than the fellowship. And thank God again for good sponsorship. Thank God for somebody who sat down and taught me those prayers. You know, they were in the medicine cabinet. They're in my car window. When I flapped down my car, the sun visor thingy, there was that prayer. It was everywhere. It drove me nuts. And I learned the third step, and I learned the seventh step, learned the 11th. I did them all. And then as we went through the steps, it was pointed out to me that there's prayer in every step. And thank God, because there were days also in the morning I couldn't even get from the bed to work. I couldn't even get to work. I was sitting down. I'm a director of human resources, so I deal with people all day long, and then I deal with people all night long. And I was trying to explain to someone, I was sitting with Carrie, because Carrie's up to her fourth step, and we were going over the basic instincts. And I got to tell you something. I love the basic instincts. In Cultsnick, we do the fourth step on the board. We take resentments from everybody sitting out there. You know, if I'm doing resentments, if it was me, I would put down my ex-husband, for instance, or the United States Army. You know, I would put down a resentment. And we'd go column by column. And then we pick a couple from everyone who's sitting out there, and we work out. And you better bring your real thick skin, because everyone takes your inventory. You've got 100 people or more taking your inventory. But it kind of shows everybody, A, that you can laugh a lot while you're doing it, because we laugh a lot. And B, it kind of gives them, you know, kind of like the routine on how to do it. And one of the things we go over are the basic instincts. And I always tell everybody, if you master those basic instincts and you understand that you're not the only one that has them, that everybody has these basic instincts, you're going to get along with people a whole lot better. I mean, it is because of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I kid you not, that I was able to become a director of human resources. Because I learned the steps, I learned the traditions, I learned the concepts, and I learned how to talk to people. I understood that if I was going to fire you, even if you were wrong and I had to terminate your employment, I knew that I was going to be messing with your basic instincts. And I don't expect you to act like a lady or a gentleman all the time. And if you don't, I'm okay with it. Because I know what I'm doing, and I'm knowing how you feel. You know? I was taught that, and I learned that. And because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I am so much of a better director of human resources, so much of a better everything, of a mother, of a daughter. You know, my parents, my dad, like yesterday, he wanted to have the talk. We were at my brother and my sister-in-law. He wanted to have the talk. He's 86 years old, God bless him. And he wanted to have the I'm going to die talk, you know, which is not a fun talk. And we've had it quite a few times, but he doesn't remember that talk. And yesterday, here we are at a 15-year-old birthday party, and Dad decided, we're going to have that talk. You know, and as much as you and I both know, it may not be the best time to have the talk, Dad. He doesn't care. But I have to remember about what the talk is. And I watch my brother get all pissy and all angry with him, and then I'm able to take my dad by the hand and go sit down in the corner while everybody's getting drunk. I mean, they were drinking beer, tequila, wine in the sun. Huh, they were drunk. It's kind of fun to watch. And I was able to sit with him, and I was able to talk to him about it. And not get pissy and not get angry. I got sad. I got really sad. But I was able to sit there and be a daughter and listen to him. Even though it wasn't something I wanted to do. I really didn't want to do it. I didn't want to do it. There was a book that I read. It's called As a Woman Thinketh. And they also have it As a Man Thinketh. And I remember that my sponsor had given it to me. And he said, when you can master what's in this book, he said, you'll be better than your sponsor. And, you know, that book was very specific on the fact of constantly saying the same thing in fancy words, that I had to change my thinking if I was going to get better. I can't live in a problem. I have to live in a solution. And I do that in every part of my life today. Every part of my life. Believe me, I have commitments all the time. I sit down at the dining room table Monday nights, Wednesday nights, Sunday nights. That's not always where I want to be. I want to be sitting on the couch eating bonbons, watching really bad TV. You know? The American Ninja thing's on now. I love that. It's on tonight's the finals. Thank God for DVRs. My daughter's like, I gotcha. I know you don't know how to use it, but I'll record it for you. But I mean, you know, that if I wasn't, that's where I would be, sitting on the couch, eating ice cream, watching these people do crazy things. But I can't. I can't. And, you know, somewhere along the line, and I don't know when it happened, but the things that I had to do became things that I wanted to do. I don't know when it happened, but I wanted to drive to Quakertown, an hour and 30 minutes away in the monsooning rain with these wonderful ladies. Somewhere along the line, it happened to just be that I wanted to do it, that I put it on my calendar and I want to do it. I want to do it. And sometimes I walk through the door and I think to myself, what could I possibly say? And that's when I know that's my ego. Because all I have to do is tell you what happened and tell you how I got better and tell you how I continue to live in the solution. You know, it's funny because the same things 19 years later, whether you got 90 days, even at 19 years later, we all have those little things that still come pecking at the door. They just don't seem so bad, so big anymore. You know, also, not for nothing, having a kid in the United States Army who's an active member and does as much as they do, all those things that I thought were so dramatic, they're really not dramatic. They're really not dramatic. You know, there's some really rough things out there. I have had the honor and the privilege and the pleasure to sit through so many fifth steps. And the minute I leave a fifth step, the first prayer that comes out of my head is, God, please let me forget it. Because it's my job to make sure that everything that I heard stays right here. And if I have an issue with it, it got to go to God. That's it. That's it. And through great sponsorship, I've been taught how to do that. You know, and all the amazing people that I've met in Alcoholics Anonymous. Page 17 of the big book and page 164 is my favorite. And page 17 tells me that we are people that normally would not mix. I mean, I remember walking into the clubhouse thinking there's a lot of people I wouldn't drink with. I would not drink with a lot of people here. And damn it, they ended up saving my life. That's just the way it works. It's an amazing thing. And then on page 164, it tells me about a fellowship that I'm going to crave. And I was able to get that going with so much help. It had nothing to do with me. Not a thing to do with me. That a meeting started on Tuesday nights at 7:30 with people that wanted exactly the same thing that I wanted. They wanted to live in the solution, not to live in the problem anymore. They wanted to be happy, not to be miserable. They wanted to see what it's like to live a happy, joyous, sober life. And that's what we do to the best of our ability. It's not always good. You know, I sit back and I watch and I think to myself, what a gift. What a gift when people walk in there so bright-eyed and ready to go. Because that's what keeps me sober. A lot of times, other people's enthusiasm. So, I want to thank you all for being here again. Karen, Michaela, what's that? Alex, Carrie, thank you for driving. Carrie was the driver tonight, and she did a hell of a job in that Honda van. and we got here right on time, so I want to thank them all. And I want to thank you all for being here and participating. Have a nice evening. Thanks.